This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. While the UN chief has called for no effort to be spared to protect civilians in the embattled Syrian province Idlib, Turkey, which shares a border with the province, repeated its call for a ceasefire in the last major rebel stronghold. Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he was making an appeal.
So much is at stake. It is absolutely essential to avoid a full-scale battle in Idlib. This would unleash a humanitarian nightmare unlike any seen in the blood-soaked Syrian conflict.
An estimated 3 million live in Idlib, with many seeking shelter there after being evacuated or displaced from conflicts elsewhere in the country. Turkey's ambassador, speaking to the Security Council, warned an offensive by Russian-backed pro-government forces, including Iranians, would only create further suffering and alienate and radicalize more Syrians. Nikki Haley is the U.S. UN ambassador.
No matter what type of weapons or methods are used, the United States strongly opposes any escalation of violence in Idlib.
She accused Russia and Iran of cynically, systematically, and ruthlessly violating de-escalation zones. Russia's UN ambassador argued terrorists, he linked to Al-Qaeda, Islamic State, and other groups, cannot be allowed to hold hundreds of thousands as human shields. The UN said some 30,000 residents of Idlib have already fled villages near the Turkish border to escape the impending assault. The leaders of Ethiopia and Eritrea have reopened crossing points along their shared border closed since hostilities broke out 20 years ago. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said troops from both countries will withdraw from the border region and return to camps to de-escalate a tense war situation. Mr. Ahmed and President Isaias Afwerki signed a breakthrough agreement back in July, officially restoring diplomatic relations. This is VOA News. In Afghanistan, at least 32 were killed, dozens wounded by a suicide bomber Tuesday during a demonstration between the eastern city Jalalabad and the Pakistani border. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. Smaller blasts in Nangarhar province targeted schools, killing a boy and wounding several children and adults. The International Criminal Court Tuesday said it was undeterred in its work after White House National Security Advisor John Bolton rejected its authority over U.S. actions in Afghanistan and threatened to prosecute ICC officials if Americans are charged with war crimes. U.S. spokesperson Heather Nauert said the U.S. bases its stand on its own sovereignty.
And that each country has its own sovereign rights, including our own. And encompassed in our own sovereign right is the fact that we have a fair and independent judiciary. We feel that that fair and independent judiciary more than backs up and takes care of any judicial issues that would confront, that would be in front of U.S. citizens and also U.S. service members.
But the head of the Afghan Human Rights Commission called the U.S. position unfortunate, insisting delivering justice to victims of war crimes will facilitate the peace process. In Spain's Catalonia region, hundreds of thousands rallied in Barcelona Tuesday in a show of solidarity with efforts to gain independence from Madrid. They mark Catalonia's National Day, observing the fall of the city to Spanish troops more than 300 years ago. The march occurred less than a year after a failed independence bid. Islamic State Tuesday claimed responsibility for an attack on Libya's state oil headquarters in Tripoli Monday that killed two staff members and wounded 10 others. Three attackers were also killed in the attack. Hurricane Florence continues to churn in the Atlantic Ocean toward the U.S. southeast coast with winds of 225 kilometers per hour. Forecasters expect it to get bigger and intensify. Four states have already declared states of emergency. President Donald Trump said he was briefed Tuesday by federal disaster officials.
The safety of American people is my absolute highest priority. We are sparing no expense. We are totally prepared. We're ready. We're as ready as anybody's ever been.
The Category 4 storm is expected to make landfall Friday, with some areas expecting rainfall totals that measure in feet. Brazil's popular imprisoned former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva Tuesday ended his bid to stand in next month's presidential election. His running mate Fernando Haddad will represent the leftist Workers' Party, Lula serving a 12-year prison term for corruption. Tech stocks drove U.S. equities higher in Tuesday trading. Tech giant Apple expected to unveil its latest iPhone Wednesday. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan warring parties will sign a final peace deal today in Ethiopia, but one group says it's not on board.
We in the UDRA are really calling for an overhaul of the government in Juba because Salva Kiir becomes a big problem for the unity and the territorial integrity of South Sudan.
Thomas Tut Duab is the General Secretary of the United Democratic Republic Alliance of South Sudan. Burundi's parliament says the government should demand an apology from the UN Commission of Inquiry on Burundi. Emotions are high as South Africa debates land expropriation. And Kenyan women demand the arrest of the murderer of a female university student.
As a woman leader from the county of Migori, I do condemn the attack and the brutal murder of one of our girls in the county.
Business persons and other professionals urge Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari to seek re-election, and activists in Guinea accuse mining executives of planning an attack on protesters 6 years ago. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Representatives of South Sudan warring parties and civil society groups are in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, where they are expected to sign a final peace deal today, Wednesday, that will end a protracted civil war. The signing will follow a summit of the regional group Intergovernmental Authority on Development, also known as IGAD, which has been facilitating the peace process. But the United Democratic Republic Alliance, UDRA, a member of the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, has written a letter to IGAD Special Envoy for South Sudan, Ambassador Ismail Wise, saying they object to the so-called Khartoum Peace Agreement. Thomas Tut Duab is a general secretary and spokesperson for the UDRA. He says the UDRA rejects the Khartoum Peace Agreement because it rewards President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar, whom he refers to as perpetrators of the conflict.
From the beginning, the process of solving South Sudan problem has never been conventional. What I mean by being conventional is that any problem, if you want to solve it, you have to attack the root causes, and then you provide solutions to those problems. That's not the case with the IGAD-run peace negotiation. And always, the solution is to come up with a power sharing, as if what caused the problem is a lack of power. Therefore, we in the UDRA are really calling for an overhaul of the government in Juba, because Salva Kiir becomes a big problem for the unity and the territorial integrity of South Sudan.
Mr. Duab, are you a member of the South Sudan Opposition Alliance?
Yes, indeed, I am.
My understanding is that the Opposition Alliance is on board to sign today's agreement. So, could it be that your group is standing on a very lonely island?
Not at all. What I mean by this, South Sudan Opposition Alliance is a group of different parties, different movements. Each and every movement or front has its own objectives and beliefs. Our colleagues, our comrades who are in the peace talks believe that what they are doing is right, but UDRA believes otherwise. Therefore, we don't condemn them while they are doing that. We don't call for their withdrawal from the peace talks. We have been encouraging to continue as they believe. However, in our side, we believe the solution to our problem is not the one that will be signed in Addis Ababa. We are going to have a South Sudanese-owned peace, not a foreign peace.
Among some of the demands you are making is that both Uganda and Sudan must withdraw their troops unconditionally from South Sudan territories. You also say that any South Sudan peace agreement must exclude President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar. Have you made these demands before? Because it seems to me they sound utopian.
Not utopian. They are realistic. They might be done because we have the power. We are the South Sudanese to invite people to our territory, and we have the right to say no to them. Now, as we speak, the Sudanese troops have occupied the northern part of South Sudan. And the other side, the Ugandan army, occupied the southern part of South Sudan. Where are we? Our South Sudanese nowadays, we have nowhere to be found. That means we are surrendering our sovereignty to the foreign nations.
Do people like you ever take into consideration the suffering of the South Sudan people, especially the amount of money that the international community has been spending to facilitate the South Sudan peace process?
Actually, James, to tell you the truth, the suffering of our people is a calculated plan by the regime in Juba to drive away our people, to make them suffer, to deny the access of aid workers to supply food and medical supplies to the rural areas. And this peace will kill most of them. We don't want a quick fix to this problem. We need a peace that will be everlasting peace with our people enjoying their freedom.
Thomas Tut Duab is the General Secretary and Spokesperson of the United Democratic Republic Alliance of South Sudan. He was speaking with me from the U.S. city of Omaha in Nebraska. Burundi's parliament has called on President Pierre Nkurunziza's government to file a complaint against the authors of the UN Commission of Inquiry on Burundi report. The report, released last week, accused government officials of gross human rights violation. And Moses Javier Rimana reports from Bujumbura.
The Burundi National Assembly, which is made up of the parliament and the Senate, released a communique calling on the government to demand compensation for the loss and damages which they say Burundi suffered. The lawmakers said the report filed by the UN Commission of Inquiry was baseless and only meant to tarnish the country's image. Pascal Barandagie, Burundi Home Affairs Minister, while addressing the parliament, said the UN Commission of Inquiry is just a tool for the European Union. He says that the Commission of Inquiry is a weapon being used by what he calls the colonialists to cause conflict among Burundians. He says all Burundians should remain united at this moment and focus on building their country. A communique was released following the debate in both the House and Senate, called on the Burundian government to file a complaint against the UN Commission of Inquiry and to demand compensation for the loss and damages suffered. However, Françoise Hampson, a member of the UN Commission of Inquiry on Burundi, said that there have been widespread hate speeches from government officials, including President Pierre Nkurunziza.
Yes, there have been examples that this year have gone right up as far as the president, and there has also been a concerning call, which is very ambiguous, on the part of a group of exiles. So it's not simply the authorities in power, although that's the main source of them.
The Commission of Inquiry expressed concern about the growing role played by the members of the ruling party youth league known as Imbonerakure in recruiting population to silence any form of criticism by the opposition. The chairman of the National Independent Human Rights Commission, Jean-Baptiste Baribonekeza, said that the report did not reflect the situation on the ground in Burundi.
We have a claim in this report that there were cases of torture at Mpimba prison. To be honest, for many years, we haven't had any claim, any allegation or, you know, complaint regarding torture at the Mpimba Central Prison. Again, we want the commission to show us who exactly they are referring to.
Burundi was the first African country to withdraw from the International Criminal Court in October last year. Still, the UN Commission of Inquiry has called for an investigation into the crimes committed since 2015 when the political crisis erupted in the country. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Today's Wednesday, September 12th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. Civil society groups and women's associations in Kenya staged a demonstration yesterday, Tuesday, blaming the government for not prosecuting a governor accused of murdering a seven-month pregnant university student who had an affair with. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, accused Migori Governor Okoff Obado will undergo DNA test as part of the investigation into the murder of university student Sharon Otiano.
That was the situation in Nairobi's Central Business Center Tuesday as women angrily expressed their discomfort with what they see as increasing cases of women being murdered by political leaders. The women said Justice is rarely served in most of the cases involving politicians.
We'd like to tell the authority that in this case, it will not be normal cases as usual. It will never be normal again. As Kenyans are tired of increasing cases of murders, where the powerful and the mighty use their position to eliminate the perceived opponent, and we shall mobilize countrywide demonstration of parents, sisters, women human rights defenders to demand the action to be taken.
Power!
Women power!
Power!
I also want to ask the authorities to confiscate travel documents of all the suspects and place them under surveillance.
The Director of Criminal Investigations, Judge Kenote, stated that DNA test is necessary in order to determine whether the governor was involved. The mother of the dead woman confirmed to the media that her daughter had an affair with the governor, but differences emerged after Sharon got pregnant and the governor wanted her to terminate the pregnancy, which she refused to do. The family has called an investigation of the matter and suspects brought to book before they can bury their kin.
What I need is justice be done as fast as possible for us to know the truth who did this.
We wanted to bury the body, but before we bury the body, we wanted to know who does that such kind of bad.
Speaking after Governor Koth Obado's grilling, his lawyers Roger Sagana and Cliff Ombeta says their client has been publicly abused concerning the matter and that the governor was not involved in the murder.
And what we have seen lately is that the medieval way of punishment by public embarrassment.
He has written his statement. He has avoided all this kind of speculation. We would wait for the arms that are given this mandate to be able to investigate this matter. Most of all, of course, he was not involved in this murder.
The women legislators have blamed the security officers for moving slowly on the case. The demonstrators say they want all suspects to step aside for the investigation.
This is the true test for the authorities in this country. Because it is alleged that the high and mighty are involved in this matter. It does not matter who you are. Nobody deserves to take away the life of another person. We want the real person involved in this matter arrested and charged.
As a woman leader from the county of Migori, I do condemn the attack and the brutal murder of one of our girls in the county.
Governor Obado and his personal assistant Michael Oyamo, who is already in custody, are today Wednesday set to appear before the court. Sharon Otieno was abducted last week alongside Nation Media Group journalist Barack Oduor, who managed to escape from the alleged assailants. Kenyans are yet to see if justice will be served, since in Kenya, most murder cases involving high-profile political leaders are often interfered with. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Plans by the South African government to allow land seizure without compensation have provoked an emotional response. Farmers, many of whom belong to the white minority, say they live in fear of losing their land. But supporters of the idea say returning land to the traditionally marginalized black majority is only right. Anita Powell reports from South Africa.
Casper Willemse grew up working a 2,000-hectare maize farm about an hour south of Johannesburg. His family has owned the farm for five generations. But Willemse faces the prospect of losing his home and his livelihood, as South Africa's government says it may change the constitution to allow expropriation of some land without compensation. Supporters of the idea say it would fix historical wrongs that left land mostly in the hands of the white minority. But Willemse says the idea fills him with anxiety and about more than just his future.
Taking something without compensation is nothing but stealing. Buying the land and giving that to somebody else, that's a different story, but just taking it for political reasons and giving it away, it's not going to yield anymore. Because that guy that is going to get it don't have passion about it, they don't have the knowledge, they don't have the resources. I think that's not going to work.
The Black First Land First movement says that is beside the point. This land, says the group's deputy president, Zenile Luana, was stolen from their ancestors and should be returned. And no one has the right to ask what the new owners plan to do with it.
We believe South Africa is a black country, and we believe that white people in this country are sitting on stolen property.
Political analyst Ralph Matega says the ruling ANC party is exploiting this sensitive issue to win votes in next year's elections. The ANC has been steadily losing ground at the polls, and an emotive issue like land redistribution could attract voters, especially lower-income black voters who comprise much of the ANC's base.
It is a genuine issue, but like all genuine issues, it is being mishandled with the view of securing short-term political gains, unfortunately.
Luana of Black First Land First also told VOA the group considers land occupation a legitimate tactic, if the government does not go through with its expropriation plans. That kind of talk worries Afroforum, which calls itself a civil rights watchdog with a focus on the white Afrikaans-speaking community. Afroforum says land seizures will hurt South Africa's economy and might trigger the kind of steep decline Zimbabwe saw when land was stripped from white farmers in the early 2000s. Ian Cameron is the group's head of community safety.
We are seeing an increase in land invasion throughout the country, so there is a definite threat to property rights at the moment, and the uncertainty being created by government increases that problem.
That's all the dust away.
Back at the farm, Willemse is carrying on. He employs 14 people, he says, and cannot leave them hanging. Besides, he says, he has no backup plan. He agrees that South Africa's violent, unequal past was wrong. But why, he asks, should he pay the price? Anita Powell, VOA News, Vereeniging, South Africa.
Business persons and other professionals have urged Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari to run for re-election. This after the groups presented him with forms needed to register for next year's polls. Buhari says defectors from the ruling All Progressive Congress, the APC, to the main opposition People's Democratic Party, the PDP, are selfish and have failed to support his vision for transforming Nigeria and improving living standards. But the opposition PDP says the defections prove that Mr. Buhari is weak and ineffective. VOA's Peter Clotte reached presidential spokesman Galba Shehu in Abuja for reaction.
Well, I confirm to you that the president has received a nomination form procured for him by a group of young, talented Nigerians who are mostly entrepreneurs, professionals who are thriving very well under the policy environment provided by President Muhammadu Buhari. He looked at the cost of the form at 45 million and said, this is beyond my salary, I can't pay for this. And so this group of young people said, no, this is not the time to lose this president. This is not the time to lose his vision and the good work he's doing for Nigeria. So they bought the form and brought it to him and he has accepted.
The president, while receiving the nomination forms, said that those who have defected from the APC and have joined the opposition party, they are displeased with this fight against corruption and ensuring the protection of life and property in Nigeria. How do you react to that? Because some people are saying that he went too far in his criticisms.
No, there's nothing like going too far. It is like a long-distance race with a marathon. When you start with a crowded group of people, you know that as you go and, achieve more milestones and run distances, there will be some who will drop off, who will break away from the train. And this is exactly what is happening. There are some with whom we started this journey together. And they have found that they cannot cope with the very high standards expected of them. And then they have dropped out. So it's like a cleansing process for our party, for the administration that is bent on changing the many wrong things that have been going on in our own country. So they're entitled to their own exit. And we allow them their freedom to do so.
Some are saying the defection makes the president look weak and ineffective in administering the affairs of Nigeria. How do you react to that?
Absolutely no. As we said to you, for us, our point of view is that it is a cleansing process. There are people who have been with the president, but they have never believed in the core principles for which he stood. War against corruption, war against insecurity and terrorism, and a restructuring of our own economy. The president is doing this the best that anybody can do, and those that cannot cope are dropping out of the race. So it's bye-bye to them and wish them the best of luck in their own endeavors.
Some are predicting that the defection could affect his re-election bid. Do you think that assessment is justified?
No, the president himself had answered this question a while ago. It will have zero effect on the president's re-election. In fact, if anything, it will boost it, because as it is, as they left, some more also are coming in. And so therefore, the president is in a good state and is doing extremely well toward the next election.
Galba Shehu, spokesman for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotte from the capital, Abuja. Guinean activists this week filed a criminal complaint with Guinea's government, alleging that mining executives helped plan police action that led to the deaths of six local residents after a protest in 2012. Jonathan Kaufman of Advocates for Community Alternatives tells Ricky Stryak about the events that led to the deaths and the evidence the recent investigation has uncovered.
People have been trying all sorts of things to get justice for the Zogota massacre. It hasn't just been 6 years of nothing. Our partners at Les Mêmes Droits Pour Tous, they took a criminal complaint against the commanders of the military and armed forces that committed the massacre back in 2012 and 2013. But that case stalled out. But then it also took a fair amount of investigation to learn what actually happened on that night.
And what did they find actually happened?
Yeah, well, what they discovered was that there had been a series of demonstrations by the local communities against the mining company because they weren't being employed. They were concerned because the mining was happening on their sacred mountain and there was going to be destruction to their sacred and important ecological sites. People from the villages had gone and occupied the mine site. The demonstrators were accused of vandalizing and destroying property. The villagers have always told us that they had no interest in destroying property, and most of the things that they were accused of destroying or stealing, they couldn't have taken anyway because they didn't have cars.
Yeah, they were larger pieces of equipment and things like that, I'm guessing.
Exactly. But all of that's more or less besides the point. The villagers had gone back to their village. They were no longer occupying the site. The government had sent a delegation of high-level ministers to look into the problem and try and settle it. That delegation, the day of the massacre, they went to the mine site and they met with the top executive of the mining company. Immediately after that meeting is when the attack more or less started. The captain of the gendarmerie that was there in the meeting went and arrested all of the security guards working for the company who came from Zogota Village. And many of those people were tortured on the way to the police station and on the way to jail. They were cut with knives, they were beaten. That same night, the people of Zogota were awakened by explosions, by gunfire. As people came out of their homes to find out what was going on, five people were murdered. They were shot with live ammunition. I think one person died after he was hit by a tear gas canister.
As part of this suit that you're bringing forth, there is belief that the mining company might be implicated in some level of this. Is that correct?
That's what we saw. And the reason that we came to that conclusion, this had never been reported before about this attack. But number one, the fact that the arrest and torture of the Zogota villagers who were working as guards came immediately after the meeting between the government and the top mine executives. The people in the village of Zogota was taken during that meeting. Then the fact that the company was fueling up the military vehicles, which are believed to be the military vehicles that were used in the attack.
That was Jonathan Kaufman with the group Advocates for Community Alternatives. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Accra, Ghana. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Representatives of South Sudan warring parties and civil society groups are in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, where they are expected to sign a final peace deal today, Wednesday, that will end a protracted civil war. The signing will follow a summit of the regional group Intergovernmental Authority on Development, also known as IGAD, which has been facilitating the peace process. That's it for this Wednesday, September 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.